You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet here in my individual capacity inside the Beltway, where everyone has a head cold and it feels like the world's coming to an end. So we're glad you're here. Thank you very much for listening. We are continuing our series on national security issues we're going to be facing with our expanding energy needs, much of which will come from the continued development of AI, AI systems. We'll talk about what those are, battery technology, the limitations on battery storage, and what is now being said to be on the horizon in years, something called quantum computing. And basically, our energy needs are going to change drastically in the coming decade. So today we're going to pivot to the technical, and we aspire to talk a bit over your head, not all of you. We're talking generally to the technical lawyers that we know inhabit the world of national security. And so we want to bring you to a deeper understanding, if you're not already at this elevated level, as many of you are, what makes AI and what makes machine learning, and how is AI or machine learning topographically different from any other algorithm-based technology? What is an AI system? How is that different from just this broader concept of AI? And why do AI systems require more energy? What causes that to be the case? And where are those systems going to be used or already being used for national security, our daily lives? And of course, the bigger and more positive question that we all like to embrace, which is the idea of improving human existence and alleviating human suffering. So to give us an understanding, we've invited Dr. Vijay, I'm going to butcher his name and then he can roll his eyes. He's free to do so. Janapa Reddy. How'd I do? Okay.
That was good.
Okay, cool. Okay, these guys at Harvard, they have these long titles. He's the John L. Loeb Associate Professor of Engineering and Applied Sciences at Harvard and Vice President, co-founder of the ML Commons, a nonprofit organization committed to accelerating machine learning innovation for all. He actively promotes machine learning education through his work. And I can say, just having looked at some of the things he's done, oh boy, does he, including authoring and editing the widely adopted open source textbook, Machine Learning Systems. It's also become a key resource for teaching machine learning systems engineering worldwide. He frequently emphasizes the often overlooked but crucial role of machine learning engineers. Now, who are these people? Don't get a picture in your head. We're going to work through this, okay? In a world centered on training AI models, noting that while ML developers are like astronauts exploring new frontiers, ML engineers are the rocket scientists and mission control specialists who make the journey possible and keep it on track. And to make machine learning accessible at a low cost, he has developed the Tiny Machine Learning, Tiny ML series on edX, which focuses on integrating machine learning into resource-constrained embedded systems. He's got a PhD in computer science from Harvard. He's got a master's in science in electrical and computer engineering. And that's from the University of Colorado Boulder. He's also got a bachelor in science from computer engineering, Santa Clara University, which is like smack in the middle of Silicon Valley or adjacent. So he's sort of been around and learned a lot of stuff. Boy, we're really glad you're here. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So you're the educator. So in basic terms, what is an AI system and how is it related to AI or machine learning? What is this stuff?
AI is quite different from anything that we've seen before. Well, actually, we've seen it before. We've seen it since the 70s and 80s, and it kind of collected dust for a little bit, which is known as the AI winter. I'll talk about that soon. But AI, as we know it today, though, is fundamentally different as compared to the way we have built the internet, the way we built the classic Google and the classic Amazon web services and so forth, because it's all data-driven. It's all about patterns. It's about learning from experiences. I think the best analogy that I can give you, given that I have young kids at home, is every day I go home, pretty much once I get home, I start spewing out a whole bunch of things. Nora, I said, do this. Nora, I said, clean up. Nora, I've told you this a billion times to like not do this. And yet she never seems to kind of pick up the fact that no matter how many times I lay out these rules, it doesn't matter. And instead, what she ends up doing is really kind of mimicking a lot of the things that I do or her mom ends up doing. In a sense, AI is like her in that she's picking up patterns of behavior that we see and replicates that, as compared to following list rules that we write on the whiteboard for her, which seem to have no effect at all. It's kind of thinking about it that way. It's like, imagine on the left side, you've got a bunch of rules. And then the other side, you've got all these different things you do. Like, she's always like, why are you always working, Dada? I'm like, I'm not working. I'm just, you know, I enjoy research. I'm just kind of asking questions. In a way, she kind of mimics that as compared to, you know, when I write out, okay, here are 10 rules you got to follow. And so in a traditional computing system, we have these rules and we tend to obey those rules. And that's how we've built computers. Now in AI, we're effectively in this world where it's all about observing patterns and learning from these patterns and kind of like, you know, trying to predict what's happening. And we can taxonomize that space of what are all the different things AI can do. But that's the fundamental difference that we're seeing in computing as we're transitioning into where we are going more with ChatGPT and all that stuff.
When people hear that, one of the things that they hear, it sounds like the algorithm begins to write another algorithm. It sort of replicates itself. And in that regard, it sounds frightening. Let's start with like large language models, because I feel like those are a little bit terrestrial to people right now. How are these different from the other AI models that we don't discuss as much in sort of main society today?
While everybody's quite excited about large language models, ChatGPTs and Geminis and all that stuff right now, AI is something we were already using very aggressively even before we knew we were using it aggressively. I mean, every single time you have been punching something into a nice little text box of Google, we were actually exercising AI behind the scenes. Now, it's a question of what kind of AI. AI has got many different personas and how we realize it. So whenever you get on Netflix, it's AI. Whenever you get on Meta, it's all AI, because they're trying to figure out what patterns of behavior we have, and then they tend to replicate that, right? Like the shows on your Netflix are very much well-suited for you. Well, when you get on shopping, well, they want you to buy every single thing that you see. And well, the way they figured that out is like, what have you been clicking? What are the kind of things you've bought? For me, in my case, this is the last item. There's only one left in stock. And guess what I do? I jump on, I got to buy it because I might miss it. So they somehow figured out that everything on the Amazon web store, for instance, for me is the last item in stock. But the point is, we've been using these systems over the past decade or so. Those are generally speaking prediction-based systems or recommendation kind of systems. In other words, they look at some pattern, they try to predict what are you likely to do. They look at certain patterns and they try to nudge you in directions. That's what the recommendation systems do. The era that we're in when we're talking about large language models and so forth, there are like generative models. They create new things out of nothing. But that's not really factually true, because in a way, they've had to learn, they've had to have experiences in order to be able to create something. But it's a really simple thing that they do. All they do, for all the complexity and all the hangama and everything that's going on, the stock markets and everything around AI, all they do is predict the next word. Now, the amazing thing about it is the fact that when you think of the next prediction, it's such a simple concept, but it could be predicting anything in the universe that's next. We're at the very beginning stages of this. Everything that's happening in the technology space right now that's moving towards personalization of these things. Already, if you use ChatGPT, it'll occasionally show you that memory's updated. These systems are learning about us, so they have memory banks that are personalized to you. It's no different than when you go on Google search. It's 100% customized for the way you try to approach the question that you're approaching. When you get on Amazon, it's completely personalized. So these systems are increasingly going to get personalized. And it depends. You're going to have a custom LLM when you come home. You're going to have a custom LLM when you're writing whatever legal briefs, for instance. It'll understand the context under which we're working, which is kind of pretty much what we all do. We're context-driven. We can be very composed when we're doing a podcast. I can be totally crazy with my kids. Right? And that's essentially what these systems are going to be doing in the future.
The other thing I think was, when early on, what was communicated to the public was some of the models were being fed from things like sweeps of social media, sweeps of Google. A couple things on that score is, one is those are dominated by a certain kind of algorithms. So there's sort of this subtextual add in to the model. The second thing is, when you're getting these public data sets, they don't really reflect reality or humanity. Obviously, if you're pulling stuff from social media, well, you're going to have a lot of inaccuracies, a lot of posturing, a lot of things that you wouldn't want to build a reliable model on, and certainly a lot of inaccurate scientific information, for example, about health. I don't know how we correct for these things, but I think that in terms of like national security, global health, and the global good, I think they're in their infancy, but I wonder then how you correct for that over time, and what other data sets you need to acquire and use to feed the model to improve the results, to make them better.
You're 100% right that there's a very strong bias in terms of data. In fact, we have written research papers ourselves on what we call as the Dollar Street Project, which is Dollar Street is a beautiful project. I encourage people to just Google and look up, which basically captures the socioeconomic diversity of the planet. And when, you know, and we happen to take that with their permission and then evaluate machine learning models. And we saw, wow, when you show what a startup looks like in a rural place as compared to what it looks like in, say, Denmark, any part of the Western world, they'll work completely fine for the Western world because, as you said, social media is fully inundated with all the kinds of pictures that we, you and I take because we have fancy phones and all these things and we load them up all the time. But that's not quite true in other parts of the world. And therefore, the models are not truly, you know, they're data-driven, right? They're learning from their experiences. So, and the only experience they get is whatever is up in the web. So you're 100% right that they're inherently biased. But I do want people to kind of keep one thing in mind. These systems are really no different than the way we raise our kids. I spend a lot of time, and so does my wife, and I'm sure everybody does, curating the environment for my kid. We almost cherry pick our friends who they hang out with. We spend more time with certain families because we're like, oh, they're great. We should really, you know, let the kids enjoy that. And then we limit their experience. We say, oh, you shouldn't be watching those kinds of TV shows. No, that's PG-13 or whatever, all these different labels. We've created an entire curriculum system in order to make sure our brains are biased towards certain things. And essentially, we'd have to do something quite similar or perhaps something quite revolutionary that guides these models in that sort of a curated path as well. And those kinds of mechanisms are lacking because all we have done so far is, you know, we're excited about this technology. We scale the model sizes up and then we observe these kinds of interesting emerging behaviors that they show, which is simply because there's such a high dimensional space that they're extracting these really complex patterns that you and I can't easily do. I think it kind of comes down to kind of keeping that in mind is that we are still figuring out how to build an ecosystem in which these models are trained and how we check them and what report cards do we produce from time to time. And, you know, there are going to be rogue models that are running around. We have to build ecosystem to control all of this.
I guess I'm trying to imagine if it's like a foundation for a house that, you know, if it's built poorly, then it's hard to add on top of that and improve it. I don't know if AI fits that sort of model. Is it you build a bad foundation and then you add data, it doesn't correct or does it correct?
That's a very deep question. In fact, technically speaking, the field at this point is really trying to understand how to work with data. In machine learning, there are really three core components that kind of hold everything together. One end is truly the data that's going into the models. Another is the model architecture, sort of like our brain, you know, how we wire it up. Is it big? Is it small? You know, it's got different levels of capacity based on how you wire up the wires. And the third element is the system element. In other words, are you humanly imagined? For example, you can be very fit or you can be sloppy. So you know, there's a physical element. So very much in computing perspective, it's that element. It's like how computationally capable are you in terms of being able to handle all the model capabilities that you need to have. So these three things are sort of the bedrock. And traditionally, when you think about data, the model, and the compute, we truly innovated in the model space first, the brain. We didn't really care about the computational efficiency and so forth. Then as we realized, wow, these things are really able to tell cat versus dog really well, then we figured out, okay, we got to improve the compute power. This is why companies like Intel, NVIDIA, Microsoft, Meta, everybody's been building custom hardware just geared for this one special task. And those two things are rather mature areas right now. The third element, which has been not really looked at very carefully, is really the data or really thinking about data efficiency. No one's really spent a lot of time poking into how do I quantitatively think about data? We understand how to think about it qualitatively. We can understand that, hey, there's a bias. The pictures don't represent all races. But it's hard to quantitatively convert that into some sort of evaluation metric. And that's that element that I think we're just on the cusp of like really understanding.
Let's do a little bit of real world applications here. RLLMs, AI systems. And if you want to just explain, what is the distinction between this kind of broader concept of AI and what an AI system is? And forgive me, because I do not have the technological expertise. My understanding is that they can be roughly grouped into about four categories. Do you mind sort of explaining what an AI system is and maybe what some of the categories are for our listeners?
The first layer, I would say, is simple prediction. That's quite common. It's almost, you know, pervasive, right? I mean, you do weather prediction. And so you can think of it as like, you know, we're doing predictions all the time in our daily lives. The next layer of that is recommendation. In my head, that's like the system is starting to nudge you. You like a certain show. Oh, let me show you other shows that I think you'll like. And it kind of takes you into these different corners. The third stage of it, which technically we call reinforcement learning and so forth, is more about exploring, where the AI agent is starting to explore things on its own. The previous two are not as autonomous. You have to nudge this system to make the prediction. You have to give it this and say, give me that. This third layer, which is exploring, is the AI agent self-exploring the space around it, like AlphaFold, which basically does protein folding and, like, you know, is discovering new compounds and so forth. It's exploring things all by itself. You set up a space and it's like playing Tetris by itself in its own world. That's a pretty powerful concept because it starts learning what works and what doesn't work. The prediction and recommendation systems don't really work that way. They're not learning anything about behavior. So ChatGPT gets better over time. There's a reason why there's a thumbs up and thumbs down kind of a thing, because it's trying to learn from your behavior. And that is fed back into what we call as the reinforcement learning human feedback loop. These models have now gotten into what we call as planning. You know, they tend to reason about things. They call thinking models. They think now. They don't just spit out the next word. They actually do a little work. You don't see this on the surface. They actually think behind the scenes. It's almost like we brainstorm. We brainstorm and we scratch out a couple of things. Then we say, okay, well, I'm going to take these things and these look important and I'm going to continue. And they have started doing that now. Now that's the third stage, which we're pretty much in right now. And the fourth stage is really, truly generative in my head. LLMs, stable diffusion, you know, these things that are generating all these cute pictures and so forth out of just simple words, they're all generative. But the true generative is going to come about when they start creating systems that we are not asking them to do. They're fully autonomous agents. And so those are the four, I would say. So going from prediction to recommendation to exploration or learning to truly generating, which is essentially, you know, taking all the prior three pieces and putting it into things and kind of creating new things that we didn't even ask them to do.
Yeah. And I think that latter bit is what scares people. Just like you talk about how you have to go in and erase and reestablish, for example, a profile or find a way to trigger a recommending algorithm to indicate, no, you really did not like to be pushed into watching this extremist political whatever. I think a lot of people are concerned about the ability to rein in at that fourth stage, something that's just sweeping and making its own decisions. And now we've lost control.
My inserting comment on that, I'm not an expert on this, but I know enough that yes, if we're not careful, we can mess things up. In all honesty, you know, I'll be transparent and say I tend to be pro-technologist and so forth. Obviously, I'm a computer scientist, you know, so naturally I tend to kind of, you know, hope everything is going to be positive, but I'm glad that there are other people who are concerned on the other side. With that said in mind, I would say, imagine when we first discovered fire, we could have just stopped. We could have said, we don't understand this. It didn't stop us from fully understanding. So sometimes it is good to be wary about that we don't understand something and understand how we should build mechanisms around it. So those are all things that I think, like, you know, we just got to keep that in mind and understand, okay, these systems are useful for generating things. Like, for example, imagine like if we were able to create a custom chip for your particular application at very low cost, that way semiconductors can be remarkably useful instead of just, you know, one big company just kind of like, you know, having to do everything for everybody. I think it opens up a really rich sort of an ecosystem of possibilities, code that can be written. Then imagine the benefits if, like, the code's able to figure out exactly what's the problem with your health condition based on just how you're behaving and so forth. It starts figuring out, okay, something's wrong, something, I got to figure this out, and starts writing. So there are lots of positive things. We just have to kind of set the stage up so that we understand when these systems might be bad. And, you know, I wouldn't say, for instance, oh yeah, we should just take these things and just deploy them into nuclear weapons or whatever the control systems end up being. I'd say, like, yeah, we should not definitely do that.
One of the concerns generally is that as these models are being built, you know, you'd like to have people review their efficacy for purpose. And I think there is also a concern that it's hard to build anything that is safe when it is in such a nascent and early developmental phase. It's hard to know where the guardrails need to be put. At the same time, I think there's the bigger question looming. You don't want to be so afraid of technology or progress that you don't allow scientific development, because it's alleviated an enormous amount of human suffering. It's increased the amount of food that's available in the world. And so it has these positive outcomes. But I think somewhere in the middle, before we get to that fourth phase, you know, there's got to be some sort of discussion between computer scientists and people who are just generally concerned about what could happen if the model goes awry.
I fully agree with you that it's important to be careful, and it's hard to kind of engineer these systems correctly when we still don't fully understand them. And that's why I certainly think it's more about, you know, having collaborations and keeping an open mind, because of the possibilities are humongous. I mean, just think about the very simple one, which I'm obviously very passionate about, which is just education. Giving equal education on this planet, which should be, you know, just birthright sort of a thing. Just anyway, if you're born, you get education for free, just the way you should be able to get air and food and water and things like that. But that's such a hard thing, especially if you're talking about AI and so forth. These are highly advanced, cutting edge topics. If we thought computers and so forth were creating a digital divide, AI is just going to widen that divide because it's much more sophisticated. In a way, you could think about from the perspective of education and say AI can teach about AI and many other things. And in effect, you know, you can kind of give that away for free because it's not that complicated once you train these models. And wouldn't that be a really positive gift?
Definitely. I think a great deal about the lack of access to education. I would also say that it's something that we've talked about on this podcast as contributing to the divide in this country. I think in rural environments where there's a reliance on property taxes to fund education, we've got a gap that could be filled through online learning if they had adequate bandwidth and could get access to this. I mean, I look at something like Khan Academy, which I think is one of the greatest gifts to humanity, really. I do believe that anything, particularly if it's an AI system, anything that would contribute to that elevating of humanity is a positive thing. Let's talk for a second about how do the developers make sure the data is reliable? Like, what do they do to ensure that what the model's being fed with is adequate for purpose and good, reliable data?
There's a term that's used in the field for this, and they're experts on this. They're called red teams, and their job is essentially like, you know, in the AI, red teams are going through data and they're trying to assess where the weak points of the model are and trying to figure out how to close the loop. I think the scary part is that the science around this is still developing. For much of what we talked about, I've been very, you know, very excited about it, but it does scare me that, like, when you actually look at how teams are deploying these systems, when they still know that, okay, you can still get the model into a pickle very quickly by not asking it anything direct. If you ask something direct, then it will obviously avoid it because you can have classifiers that detect that. But these red teaming experts are essentially trying to figure out how you have to prevent the model from answering things when it's kind of subtly nudged into a corner where nothing gets triggered. And that's a crazy combinatorial space. And the science is still maturing in that space, I would say. And I think that's what's kind of like alarming. But everybody's doing their best. I mean, every company, OpenAI, talks about their red teaming effort. Claude says it's the first priority is getting that kind of stuff right before they put anything out. But these models are not perfect. What's fascinating and challenging about these generative models is that there's no ground truth. I think that's the most important thing for people to really understand. At that point, I will agree with people that, yes, this is why it's hard to engineer it properly. You know, most of the time when you say, hey, is this a cat or a dog? There's a ground truth associated with it. Everybody agrees it's a cat or it's a dog. But when you go into these kinds of things, which is like you show a picture and you say, huh, is there anything, let's say, politically incorrect or, you know, something disturbing for a kid? That depends on our unique experiences, which comes back to the starting point where you were asking about context and so forth. And I think that is something important for people to keep in mind, that that's when it gets really hard because there is no one universal ground truth for certain questions.
Hey, podcast listeners, this is Holly, and tagging on to Elise's great discussion, just to remind you all that the committee is now accepting nominations for the Morris Liebman Award. The deadline is March 14. We'll link to the nomination form in the reference section. But as some background, the Liebman Award in Law and National Security was established by our committee, which honors the memory of Morris Liebman, a distinguished lawyer, co-founder of our committee, and recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The award recognizes Maury Liedman's lifelong dedication to the rule of law, leadership in the field of law and national security affairs, and continuing support for those engaged in this field. Persons eligible for this award must have demonstrated a sustained commitment and made contributions to the field of law and national security, whether through government service, legal scholarship, or otherwise. Again, we'll link to the nomination form in the reference section of this podcast, along with a list of past recipients. Remember, the deadline is March 14th.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.